For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. Mexican voters go to the polls tomorrow to vote for a new president. The presumptive victor in tomorrow's election is Enrique Peña Nieto. But an ongoing investigation by a British newspaper has uncovered new evidence that a major Mexican television broadcaster has been funding a secret campaign to promote Peña Nieto and smear his rivals, including leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who narrowly lost Mexico's last presidential election in 2006. Corruption of media coverage of the presidential election emerged as a major campaign issue last May, thanks to a growing student movement in Mexico. We're joined today by Peter Watt, a lecturer in Hispanic studies at the University of Sheffield in Glasgow, Scotland, where he specializes in Latin American politics and history, including new social movements in Latin America and freedom of expression and censorship in Mexico. He is the author, with Roberto Zepeda, of Drug War, Mexico, Politics, Neoliberalism, and Violence in the New Narco Economy, due for release on July 17th by Zed Books. Peter Watt, welcome to Sounds of Dissent.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you join us. We're on the line live again with Peter Watt from Glasgow, Scotland. Peter Watt, this media scandal story is all over the British press, or at least the newspaper The Guardian, which has been investigating it. But the only significant coverage I've seen of it in the United States is in the Huffington Post, and then just a little over an hour ago in Forbes on their website. What do you make of this scandal?
First of all, just a minor correction. I'm in Sheffield, which is in England, but I'm from Scotland. But anyway.
Forgive me my geography.
don't worry, that's fine. It's a long way away. I wouldn't say it's having massive media coverage here. It's true that it has been reported in The Guardian, which is one of the major papers here. But basically, the Mexican elections, the issues, you know, the current crisis in Mexico, does get reported here, but never perhaps with the context it deserves. But you're right that the recent articles that have appeared in The Guardian are quite damning of Peña Nieto's campaign and of the PRI. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with what that means, but that's the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which was voted out of power after having held power for 70 years in Mexico from the end of the revolution up to the year 2000. The PRI always had was always very allied with the elite media, and particularly Televisa, which is the organization at the center of this. It's also kind of interesting how the organization responsible for leaking these documents, WikiLeaks, because many of these documents came through the U.S. Embassy, or some of them came from the U.S. Embassy cables.
These are WikiLeaks documents?
The Guardian.
I wasn't aware of that. I didn't see that coverage. You're saying
Some of the initial ones were WikiLeaks documents from the U.S. Embassy cables, which talked about similar things. And then subsequently, there were other documents that were leaked to The Guardian reporter Joe Tuckman by people who had worked, by previous employees of Televisa. So that's what's been happening here, and of course that's provoked a reaction from Televisa, put Televisa very much on the defensive, and they've demanded an apology and denied these allegations, and it's also significantly undermined Peña Nieto's campaign. One of the things that has really come to the center, I think, of this election campaign is that the mainstream media in Mexico are a problem, and the way that they cover political affairs and the way that they cover the business affairs is problematic.
What was the role of the student movement in making this a campaign issue? This, if you would,
that's really important. The Peña Nieto in May went to visit the Universidad Iberoamericana, which is just outside Mexico City. And it's a private university. Students are overwhelmingly middle class. So I imagine he and his advisors thought that this was a safe bet. But his welcome there was he was met by student protesters who were very vociferous in their criticisms and in their questioning, to the point that he had to, as he was kind of leaving, he had to go and hide in one of the restrooms before his security guards could find him a safe exit. So I think that in itself is significant. Then what happened after that was that his campaign and Televisa portrayed this as students as kind of instigators who had been paid by the campaign of AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's the candidate from the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD. So he's Peña Nieto's main opponent in this election, sort of leftish leaning, at least much more left than the other two candidates, the two main candidates. And the way they portrayed this and the way that Televisa portrayed this was that these guys were paid by López Obrador, by his campaign, and that they weren't really students. And therefore, their criticisms were manufactured, if you like. So 131 students got together and posted a video on YouTube showing their university identity cards, their credentials, on screen and said, "We are 131. We are 132, actually, because 132, the 132nd, is the population of Mexico." That video went viral, and of course, you know, very much undermined his campaign. It's pretty interesting that there's another significant student movement appearing in Mexico, and I think, in my view anyway, that's a cause for some measured optimism, at least, because the fact is that the media has become a central issue, and Televisa, for example, is the largest and most powerful media empire in the Spanish-speaking world. So its scope of influence, you know, extends well beyond Mexico. But within Mexico, I don't know the exact numbers, but I believe that about 60% of all the channels are owned by Televisa. And pretty much the rest are owned by TV Azteca, TV Azteca. So you've got an effective duopoly. You've got these two very powerful media giants controlling the message that goes out.
The Guardian, 3 weeks ago, published, if you don't mind, The Guardian published documents dating from 2005 that it says contains right. evidence of a smear campaign that one of these, Televisa, sure. conducted against the leftist, or sort of left of center anyway, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Now, that was in the 2000 election in which he ran, and he lost by half of a percentage point. So that's pretty significant, right. isn't it?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I was there in 2005 when, in the midst of this smear campaign, it was quite incredible, the kind of viciousness that the mainstream media were that they came up with to undermine and to kind of demonize López Obrador, you know, so they would compare him to Hitler, to Mussolini, and of course Hugo Chavez, and the kind of dominant message was López Obrador un peligro para México, which is López Obrador, a danger for Mexico. So very much based on this discourse of fear. And and then they tried to impeach him for, because he was mayor of Mexico City, for a minor planning, something to do with planning regulations, and he hadn't completed some planning regulation properly, and anyway, they made a big thing of this. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that Televisa were involved in this kind of campaign. I think that maybe one of the things that's changed in Mexico is now that it used to be that the politicians would, every time the media got out of line, they would punish them in certain ways. And of course, the mainstream media depended very much on the government because they received a lot of public subsidies. And of course, Televisa used to be a nationally owned company. It was subsequently privatized. But then, now that you know they're much more private affairs, if you like, and the subsidies aren't so great, they charge for. Well, in this case, Televisa has been charging for positive coverage. So Peña Nieto, according to these documents, was able to pay for positive coverage. And of course, the documents that you just referred to talk about the political machine paying for this smear campaign against López Obrador.
Who is López Obrador? Could you say something about him? He has emerged in recent weeks as a real contender in these elections.
That's
He's
right.
trailing, I guess the last official poll was Wednesday, and he was trailing by 7% from Nieto. But that seemed to surprise observers, much the way that the Syriza leftist coalition surprised commentators in Greece. I wonder if you could tell us what accounts for his meteoric rise recently, but I think he's been planning this campaign for some time, right?
Yeah, he has. And in 2006, despite the mediatic campaign against López Obrador, he still got within a breath of winning the presidency in 2006. And that election was very contested. And the PAN, the National Action Party, the kind of right-wing neoliberal party led by Felipe Calderón, who were the party that's still in power, there were numerous accusations that the presidency had been stolen, that López Obrador had won, and the protests which erupted following the election after July that year were probably the biggest in Mexico possibly ever, I think. So you had, a million to 2 million people in the central square of Mexico City, López Obrador speaking to them, addressing them. So despite all of that, he did manage to garner, a significant number of votes. The PRD, the party that he leads, was a kind of it's many of the people in it are former members of the PRI. In the 1980s, the PRI kind of abandoned its revolution. Well, what was called its revolutionary project, which was to subsidize major industries and agriculture, invest in social programs. Mexico's public spending was much higher than other countries in the region. There were certain measures for protecting the economy from external competition and so forth in order to protect farmers and national industry. And in order that Mexico be relatively food self-sufficient. But in the 1980s, it begins to abandon that model in favor of a neoliberal program, which becomes even more pronounced in the 1990s with the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, accord. And the people at the top of the party are, they're much more technocrats. They're the who've been educated in Harvard and Princeton and Oxford. And so the nature of the party changes, and so there's a split. And actually, the person, one of the most prominent figures, dissenting figures within the party, is Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, who's the son of Lázaro Cárdenas, who was one of the founders of the PRI, and responsible for almost Keynesian economic model that, that Mexico adopted after in the 1930s. So the whole nature of the party, you know, they're expelling the people who helped found the party, if you like.
Was this in exchange for debt relief from during the debt crisis in the 80s?
Right. So in 1982, there was a debt crisis, and the New York banks come in and offer to bail out the Mexican economy, but on the condition that they begin to restructure the economy in favor of this neoliberal model, cut social spending. Well, one thing they do is nationalize the banks, but they're subsequently privatized in the 90s. So that was the context of it, and that's how the PRD kind of emerged as a political force, because during the reign of the PRI, the PAN, the National Action Party, was really the only major oppositionary force. There were minor parties, and even many of the minor parties were illegal until I think the 1970s or early 80s. So you basically had a one-party state with a one-party opposition. So there's a certain amount of pluralism now. I wouldn't want to overstate it, but the fact that there's a major party now challenging the economic model that was adopted in the 80s and the 90s, I think is a significant change. And it's true that López Obrador has actually moderated some of his rhetoric, I think probably in order to gain more support from wider sectors of the population, but also from the business community. So there are elements of the business community who actually support López Obrador now. So that's very significant. The PAN, I don't know if you would like me to talk a little bit about the PAN. They came to power in 2000. Yeah, if we've got time, yeah. So the PAN came to power after, in the 2000 elections. The PRI was so discredited by years of authoritarianism, corruption. You know, it's quite often called the PRI dinosaur, because it'd been in power for 70 years, and probably the PRI leadership believed that they were going to be eternal. But because up until the 1980s they had provided a certain amount of support for society's most vulnerable, social programs, the trade unions were very strong in Mexico, even though there was constant government interference. All of those things were important, but so the PRI was able to kind of maintain control, this kind of umbrella control of all these, or co-opt different sectors of the population. You know, so going from peasant movements to trade unionists to the business elite, and it tried to cater for all those interests, but they stopped doing that as of the 1980s and into the 1990s. So those minor protections that were off and subsidies for small farmers, for the food industry, for food producers, those get taken away. And the result is that many more people are forced into poverty almost immediately. As soon as the NAFTA agreement signed in 1993 and comes into effect in 1994, it has a dramatic effect on small-time farmers who are forced to migrate to the cities or to the Maquiladora belt, which is in the north of Mexico, or to the United States. One of the reasons why migration to the United States became so massive in the 1980s and the early 2000s.
Almost all U.S. commentary about Mexico focuses on either Mexican immigration to the United States or the Mexican drug cartels. And you've just made a good point. Not many people realize there has been the significant growth in Mexican immigration to the U.S. until recently directly came of NAFTA and the collapse of agriculture, right? The small farmer sector, once those subsidized U.S. crops started pouring into the country.
That's right. I mean, the terrible irony, you know, so back in 1960, Mexico was predominantly food self-sufficient, and the effect of the NAFTA Accord, all of these free trade agreements, is that the richer nations, so like the United States, Canada, for example, where agriculture was subsidized, and therefore, you know, U.S. corn could be sold cheaply because it had been subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer. Well, there's a kind of surplus of, for example, it's corn, a surplus of U.S. corn. What are we going to do with it? We'll sell it to poor people in Mexico and it will be cheap. At the same time that happens, the NAFTA agreement, one of the conditions of the NAFTA agreement is to remove subsidies for farmers, for small farmers, and also to remove and dismantle the system of stores where the poor could buy food that was subsidized, and where small-time farmers could sell their products. So that all gets removed, and then there's the kind of influx of cheap products from abroad. Well, Mexico starts importing corn. It's probably the first time in Mexican history that's ever happened, that it's importing a product that's been made for, you know, been grown for millennia. So that's one of the things. And then, of course, well, all those people who are employed or impoverished, one of the obvious things for them to do is to get involved in criminal organizations. I mean, the person with whom I wrote the book, Roberto Cepeda, he's from Sinaloa in northwest Mexico, and he told me that, on various occasions he was made offers to go and work for trafficking organizations, and when he told me what the wages were, it didn't sound great to me. But it was a significant improvement on what most people can earn around there. So we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, one, migration to the United States increases, and the labor force, the kind of flexible labor force for the drug cartels, you know, is a bigger labor pool as a result. Of course,
Could you say something about Calderon's, so the outgoing president, Felipe Calderon, made fighting the drug cartels the centerpiece of his presidency. And, you know, and since then we see the result. There have been press reports of up to 60,000 people killed in the last five years. And a lot of this, I guess, as some of this is from the police as well as from the drug cartels. Right. And you've just written a book about this. For listeners, again, I'm speaking with Peter Watt, and I'm speaking now about your new book, Drug War, Mexico, Politics, Neoliberalism, and Violence in the New Narco Economy. You make an interesting case there about the war on drugs, which the United States has supported. Can you say something briefly about that?
Sure. I mean, I suppose the war on the narcos by Calderon is probably akin to George Bush's war on terror. It's got, just as the war on terror had nothing to do with terror, the war on drugs has nothing to do with drugs, or so it seems. As I mentioned to you earlier, the election of Calderon was fiercely contested, and so he was a president who came to power with very little sense of legitimacy. Remember that in the year 2000, Mexicans had really been looking forward to, there was a lot of hype made about this democratic transition. There's going to be democratic plurality in Mexico once we get rid of the PRI. So that was in 2000, and 6 years later, there's such disillusionment with the PAN's program that the transition to democracy didn't deliver its promises. That's why I think López Obrador did so well. But anyway, so the new president comes to power with, there isn't any kind of legitimacy to it. There are, there's a great deal of skepticism about it. And one of the first things he does, 10 days after taking power in December of that year, he dispatches even more troops and police to the street. So by that time, about 50,000 troops and police patrolling the streets and setting up a quasi-permanent presence in some areas of Mexico. So, you know, that number of troops is equivalent to how many Mr. Blair sent to occupy and invade Iraq. But this is an internal control, an internal war. But if you look at the reasons that were given for it, just like the war on terror, it's almost like the justifications changed every day, depending on which one they thought would work. One of the main ones that the Calderon government offered was crime. We need to do this to combat crime. But in fact, the crime rates in Mexico had fallen, according to the government's own figures, had fallen slightly in the preceding years. So I think that should allow us some scepticism. And of course, crime has increased in the last 6 years significantly. It's I think the homicide rate has doubled since 2006, since this crackdown.
So what was the real reason, in your view?
Well, I think, first of all, the war on the narcos served as a distraction from all these other issues that the PAN was refusing to address. Because after 6 years in power, the PAN hadn't delivered. There were more people in poverty than there had been previous to the PAN rule, and yet there were more millionaires and more billionaires. So if you can stomach looking at the Forbes magazine website of the 100 richest people in the world, Mexico is very highly represented. So what happened with neoliberalism under the PRI and under the PAN was that the disparities between rich and poor just increased enormously. And so, the world's richest man, Carlos Slim, who benefited from the privatization of Telmex, the telecommunications company, he became the richest man in the world. He acquires, on average, it's estimated, $27 million every day. But the majority of Mexicans are poor, or over half the population live in poverty, and earn less than $2 a day. And concurrent with that was a rise in prices of basic foodstuffs. So for tortillas, for milk, for beans, the prices suddenly rose following NAFTA. So all of those issues that they should have been addressing and that people were hoping that they would address, they preferred instead this diversionary tactic, I think, of this drug war.
We have time for just one last question. Yeah. I'm sorry. Peter Watt, this Mexican election tomorrow takes place in the wake, we haven't talked about this, in the wake of an attempted rollback, it appears, of leftist governments in Latin America, as yet another president was deposed in what Latin American leaders are calling a parliamentary coup d'etat. That's Paraguay. There was before that Honduran President Mel Zelaya. There was an attempted coup against Ecuador's President Rafael Correa. That's so right. I don't know if you want to just say a word about that.
As well. And then
and Aristide
in Haiti, right. And then the coup attempt against the Chavez government.
Does Washington have a horse in this race, in this election? Because Washington has been notably quite silent about this latest coup d'etat in Paraguay just a week ago.
Right.
What's being called a coup,
yeah,
in any case.
I mean, there's no question that Washington has massive interests in the Mexican elections and who's in power. One of the reasons, one of the biggest foreign aid programs was to the other U.S. ally in the region, Colombia. And as you recall, I'm sure they were funding the Plan Colombia initiative. It's almost like that same policy has been applied to Mexico. So I think that Mexico, outside the Middle East, has become the largest foreign aid program for the U.S. government. So it was initiated by Bush and then implemented largely by the Obama administration. And so they're spending billions of dollars. In the first year, the Obama government spent, in 2009, spent $1.8 billion on this. Incidentally, it's funding for Mexico, Central American countries, and the Dominican Republic. But most of the money goes to Mexico. And, of course, when they say foreign aid, it's all military aid. It's all military spending. And, of course, not a penny of that leaves the United States, because it goes to U.S. military contractors, it goes to the U.S. Army. The irony is that Mexico, since this democratic transition, Mexico was one of the few countries in Latin America which didn't have a military dictatorship for most of the 20th century after the Mexican Revolution. There was the PRI, kind of authoritarian democracy, but there wasn't a military dictatorship. Now, with supposed democracy, we see this increasing militarization by the state.
So, Peter Watt, I'm afraid we're out of time.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
It's been great to have you. Thank you. Bye-bye. We've been speaking with Peter Watt, a lecturer in Hispanic Studies at the University of Sheffield. We've been speaking about the Mexican presidential elections due to take place tomorrow. Peter Watt is the author, with Roberto Cepeda, of Drug War Mexico, Politics, Neoliberalism, and Violence in the New Narco Economy, due to be released on July 17th by Zed Books. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.